Hello, and welcome back for a special episode of the Botchtuber podcast. Today, we're thrilled to bring you an engaging conversation between two esteemed guests, Lotta Balin and our special guest host, Gary Cohen. Lotta Balin is a trailblazer in the field of organizational behavior and the daughter of acclaimed Austrian social scientists Marie Yehoda and Paul Lazarsfeld. Her pioneering research on work-life integration and gender equality has had a profound impact on workplaces around the world. Joining her is Gary Cohen, a longtime member of the Botchtuber Board of Advisors and a distinguished professor from the University of Minnesota, renowned for his experience in modern European history, particularly focusing on Central Europe and the Jewish experience. In this episode, Lotta shares parts of her remarkable life story, from her family's famous Austrian roots to her academic and professional collaborations. Austria has played a significant role in shaping Lotta's perspectives and achievements. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy this captivating conversation that delves into the intersections of personal history, cultural connections, and pioneering scholarship.
This is Gary Cohen. I am a professor emeritus of Central European history at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. I'm also a member of the advisory board of the Botchtuber Institute of Austrian American Studies. And it's my great privilege today to have a chat with a most distinguished professor emerita of organizational studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Sloan School of Management. Lotta Lazarsfeld Balin is a renowned expert in work and organization studies with special emphasis on the dynamics of gender and diversity in business organizations and academia. She's a particularly apposite subject for the blog of the Botchtuber Institute by virtue of her birth in Vienna in 1930, her parentage, and her many contacts with the traditions of Austrian intellectual life in the early 20th century. Let me begin by asking, what are your earliest memories of Vienna, if you have any, from those early years between your birth and then your leaving in 1937?
Well, it's a funny one. Before 1934, one of the things my mother and I often did was to sing the International. And I remember her in 1934, after the Social Democrats lost the Civil War, that she told me, "We're not allowed to sing the International anymore." And because the Social Democratic Party had been declared illegal by the Austro-fascists. And I somehow remember that.
I understand that your mother, Marie Yehoda, was an ardent supporter of the Austrian Socialist Party and eventually joined one of its left radical groups, and that you were living in one of the great architectural accomplishments of Red Vienna and the Karl Marxhof. What do you remember of living there?
I don't remember anything. I think we moved out when my father left and I was between 2 and 3. So I was recently back there and had a tour and saw it, but I don't remember anything of it from before. The only other memory I have of Vienna, and I don't know whether I was told this or whether I really remember it. One part I think I do remember. I was in the Montessori school, and evidently I came there one day and there were flowers on my desk. And I asked people why, and they said, "Because your mother's in jail." Now, that part I'm not sure of. I do remember my uncle taking me out for chocolate and explaining to me that my mother did not do anything bad, that she just is in jail for political reasons. I don't know what words he used, but I do vaguely remember that in the coffee house, that discussion, because previously they had told me she was just away.
Well, your father had left Austria in 1933 to go to the United States to pursue research and employment opportunities that looked to be better for him there than was possible in depression-ridden Austria. Your mother had stayed behind. When your mother was arrested by the Schuschnigg government, she was kept, I think, for some 9 months in prison. Who took care of you while she was in jail?
Well, my grandmother, but it was a big family. Her sister, you know, it had been sort of family caretaking for some time. My aunts took care of me. I have a cousin who's almost the same age as I am. So there was a lot of mutual support. But basically, I was with my grandmother, which I had been a lot anyway, even before then.
Your parents met, if I understand correctly, in the Institute for Psychology run by Charlotte and Carl Bueller. From that base began work on what became a classic study of the impact of unemployment in an industrial district on the outskirts of Vienna, the famous study, the unemployed of Marienthal. Vienna in the 1920s and into the early 30s saw a great ferment and flowering of important new work in the social sciences, in philosophy, in language theory that had far-reaching effects on the respective disciplines. And your parents, both of them, Paul Lazarsfeld and Maria Yahuda, were very much in the middle of all of that. At what age did you become aware of the sort of work they were doing or of the activity that they, and connections that they had?
Oh, very late. Very late. I mean, when I came to America, it was probably, you know, as I was beginning to go to college or something. I knew that they were working on things. I knew my father and stepmother were always working. But what the content was, I don't remember being very much aware of. I knew there were connections when I was in America. I know that on D-Day, Frank Stanton, the head of CBS at that time already, called very early in the morning to tell my father that the invasion had begun. But nothing, you know, I was not particularly aware of what they were doing, except that they were always working.
Well, you came to the U.S. at age 7, and you grow up, you didn't see your mother again, I believe, until, what was it, 1945? She, when she was released from prison, she ended up going to Great Britain and only came to the U.S. in 45. Am I correct?
Yes, you're correct.
Did you, to what extent, you know, living in your household of your father and stepmother, both social scientists born and educated in Austria from families of Jewish origin, to what extent did you feel something of an outsider growing up and going to school in America?
Well, I'm sure the beginning was tough, not only because I didn't know the language, but I really didn't know my father hardly at all and had never met my stepmother. So I'm sure that was a complicated time. I attribute the fact that I still have a slight accent to sort of my not being happy about this initial transition, but that I don't know if that's correct or not. It may just be my throat, the way it's built. I realized that I was different from the American Jewish kids in my class who, you know, belonged to synagogues and did all the right things, something we never did. We were completely secular. And I remember thinking, isn't it funny that my Jewishness is what brought me to America, but I'm the one who doesn't deal at all with any of the holidays. So,
but that was not unusual among Central European Jewish refugees in the 30s who came from educated, assimilated families. That was more often the norm than the exception to have very little.
Absolutely the norm among that group, but not the norm among the American group. And I was living in an American environment, dealing with American friends, not with refugee people.
I see.
Yeah.
Let's move forward to you going to college. You went to Swarthmore, one of the great American liberal arts colleges with very high standards, a very different sort of educational environment than anything that your parents or stepmother would have experienced in Austria. You chose at Swarthmore a mathematics major, which I find an interesting happenstance. Your father made his career in social psychology and sociology and related areas. His doctorate was actually in mathematics at the University of Vienna, but he left mathematics early. He went to the Bueller's Institute and essentially retooled with them. But how did you land on mathematics at Swarthmore?
Well, I'm sure it was his influence. I mean, he didn't fully leave mathematics. He kept it up in application to social science issues, his latent structure analysis. So his way of thinking remained really as a mathematician. And his son, my half-brother, has indeed become a mathematician. So it seemed almost, you know, like the family business. That's what you do. And I followed through until I took some graduate courses between my junior and senior year and realized I really didn't have it. There were certain things I could do. I could deal with complex variables and with matrix algebra, but I had no idea how to approach a theorem, and so I decided that's not going to work. And I had never seen it as part of science, because the minors I took were psychology and a little bit of economics. No, it wasn't physics or chemistry.
Was it that minor in psychology that eventually led you to do graduate studies at Harvard Radcliffe in social psychology?
Yeah, I think so. It was social science. That was the social relations department, which combined social psychology with sociology, with clinical psychology, and with cultural anthropology. It was an experiment that lasted about 10 years or so at Harvard, and I just hit it. And initially I thought I would apply mathematics to social science, but then I gave that up and just proceeded almost by accident from one job to another until I ended up 16 years after my PhD at the Sloan School.
That, in my understanding, was often the case for women scholars of your generation, a terrible difficulty in getting normal faculty appointments for years and years, and the fact that there were very, in those years in the great American research universities, very few tenured women, very few women on the faculty in on continuing appointments in general. How discouraging did you find that situation?
Well, it's interesting. My dissertation advisor told me that he would have loved to keep me as an instructor. At that time, people started as instructors, but he couldn't appoint me because instructors in the department have to do tutorial in the houses, and no woman can do that tutorial. So I had a series of research lecturer jobs and so for those 16 years. And of course, I didn't know how it would end. And so there was some frustration. On the other hand, I had much more control over my life than women students have today. And I could say no to things if I didn't want them. I could go part-time. I could go full-time. And it was much easier for me to bring up our two sons than it is, I think, for people today. So looking back, it was not at all a bad way to go. And as a matter of fact, I've written about this and I have some data on it showing that this kind of a slow burn way, or I called it apprenticeship model at one point, is really ideal for both men and women. Instead of imposing the most difficult career times on top of the optimal family times, but today, partly because of age discrimination, I wouldn't dare advise a woman student to do it, even though I think it would be better for everybody.
Well, indeed, and we see many cases of women assistant professors on a tenure clock facing enormous challenges if they also want a family life. One option some universities are taking that I think you've taken a look at is the opportunity to stop the tenure clock for childbearing, child rearing, or take leave, family leave. I'm not sure that that's an adequate solution, but it shows the awareness of the problem that you identify.
Yeah, but what the real thing that has to be done is to rethink the whole timing issue. Why are the first 7 years the critical years? It doesn't make any logical sense. It's just this is the way it's always been, and it's never previously been thought as problematic, so it's now assumed that you have to do this, but I don't think that's true. But nobody is questioning those structural issues.
Let me go back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago in passing, that how much you benefited from the open interdisciplinary character of the teaching, the research, the discourse in Harvard's program in that department of social relations. And that's that the impact of that and the how appropriate that was for you, I think is apparent. And when one looks at the arc of your research projects and research activities over the many years, in that there the wide-ranging character of your inquiries in organizational dynamics and practices. I'm wondering, though, was there perhaps at least some indirect impact, or at least a resonance in that open hybrid approach that you took to identifying problems, looking at research modes and methods, some resonance of the this openness to different methods and question asking in your parents' work and the way they were brought up in that cauldron of innovation in the social sciences in Vienna at the end of the 20s and the beginning of the 30s, and perhaps some inspiration from your once you were college age or in graduate school, as you understood your parents' work better, some direct or indirect inspiration from their wide-ranging work that might have encouraged you to think outside the box, so to speak.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of what I've done has many ties to the kinds of things that they did. I moved more from work like my father than to work like my mother, and finally, pretty late in life, to something a little bit of my own, and very much so. I mean, I think I fell into a lot of things because of the models that I had. I didn't have to make many independent choices.
But you did find your own way. No one would question that. But what I'm wondering about is does that represent some specific Austrian or Viennese heritage that never really faded away with you?
Not intellectually, because I didn't have it, but as an identification, Vienna plays a role. Maybe to justify my accent, or because there are aspects that I like about having a bit of an independent identity. But as I learned on my recent trip, people don't consider themselves, or what we heard, Catholics or Jews or Austrians, they consider themselves Viennese. It's a identity all its own. And besides the fact that I like the food there, you know, it fits me better than any other food. And
well, did you keep some of the cuisine at home?
Yeah. I remember the first time my husband and I went to Vienna, we were at the market, and I said with some surprise, "Look, everything I like is in this market." And then we left, because it's not so surprising. Typically, what you grow up with is what you like.
When did you first go back to Vienna after World War II?
It's a good question. I think it's in the late 50s, something like 57. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think it's about then.
Did you go with your father?
No, went with my husband.
Uh-huh.
And then once the kids were little, our oldest was born in 59, we spent summers in Austria, or at least a month in various parts of Austria. And then, as I said, recently I was back. But before that, I took the whole family to Vienna for my 80th birthday.
Well, I hope that was a wonderful experience.
It was very nice, yes.
Your father, thinking about the arc of the intellectual traditions with which he started, and the determined efforts in the Schuschnigg era, and of course in the Nazi era, to stamp out so much of that, so that the social sciences in Austria and the humanities as well were, when Austria came out of World War II and the Nazi period, came out of that those experiences utterly impoverished. And we have studies now of how few new habilitations, appointments of new blood to professorships were, for instance, in the Vienna University through the 1950s. Not only was so much of the most innovative work stamped out, but there were many who had survived nicely the Schuschnigg dictatorship and then the Nazi era, who were still in place through the 50s. Your father, along with Oscar Morgenstern, made an effort at the beginning of the 1960s to resuscitate the social sciences in Austria by founding an Institute for Advanced Studies to provide training in the social sciences up to international standards. And at least at the beginning, they got some very talented doctoral students, postdoctoral students, who enrolled. In the longer, there was a great deal of resistance in the university communities in Austria to this. And I read that your father was frustrated. Did you have conversations with him about that? Or did you visit Vienna in the early 60s once that that institute got started?
Yeah, no, I did know that. He wanted this Ford Institute to be a little bit like the Columbia Institute, you know, where there's training and collaborative work. And he never felt that that came to be. And I think, you know, that happened in the United States too. He wanted the center at Stanford to be more of a training center, and it did not work out. And just before he died, he had moved to the University of Pittsburgh trying to set up something there. And yeah, I think he was disappointed by the fact that his vision of what training in social science would be did not go over either in Austria or in the United States.
I think he began to think about such research institutes already before he left Austria in 1933. And this is was a kind of long-term dream of his, which was repeatedly frustrated. There's this, I'm sure this is something that you thought about, given your long experience on the faculty at MIT, of the siloing of people in their disciplinary boxes in departments committed to one discipline and its specialties, and the bean counting of who gets credit for grants and who offers the courses that work so strongly against interdisciplinary activity.
It isn't even so much interdisciplinary, but a form of education. Now, it was successful for many years at Columbia with the Bureau of Applied Social Research, but it's no longer there, or not in that form. So that was the model. It just didn't really take any place else.
The European university landscape has begun to change significantly as a byproduct of the European Union and the initiatives associated with what's called the Bologna process, and the trying to raise the expectations for doctoral degrees, to beef up the master's degrees for students who really don't want to go on to research degrees, but used to get doctorates just to go teach in secondary schools. and more specialized doctoral seminars to accomplish this, and then the Erasmus fellowships to give graduate students an opportunity to study for a semester or a year somewhere else in Europe. Have you sensed any real progress in raising standards, opening up, broadening intellectual horizons among graduate students or colleagues in the fields in Europe, in the fields you have worked in?
Our graduate students, our PhD students, for example, are very open, very eclectic. Our whole organization studies is now part of a larger group called Work and Organization Studies, and includes the Institute for Work and Employment Research at MIT. And the type of work that people do there ranges from laboratory experiments to huge surveys to ethnographies, you know, and covers a complete variety of topics and issues. So I've had the feeling that our part of the Sloan School has actually been fairly open to methods and content and to let people, you know, go outside the quote mainstream. And I think that's been good.
Well, indeed. What I'm wondering is to what extent the transatlantic conversations in this field with your counterparts at institutions like the University of Economics in Vienna or other comparable institutions in Germany or Italy or Britain show any real multi-sided conversations going on at the same level? As has the discourse truly become international in your field?
Well, I really don't know much about, you know, I have no conversation with universities elsewhere. In certain groups I belong to, there are people from other parts of the world, mainly Europe. And so I hear them. I think in social science, the Europeans are more open generally than the Americans are to more the kind of work that I find interesting, which is more phenomenon-based, not so positivistic, not so geared to theory and special statistical techniques. I find the European work that I know more open to this kind of more qualitative, more phenomenological work. I have very little contact except casual, occasionally, through some groups that I belong to. For a while, I participated on the advisory boards of a number of EU-sponsored research programs, primarily geared to getting women into the university. They were financed by the EU, but most of the ones I was involved in were located primarily in Italy, and that was interesting. But that's now 20-some years ago, so I really, you know, haven't kept up in any way.
Well, it's of course a very long career that you've had. Well, since getting your degree in what was it, in 56, and then beginning on a regular faculty appointment in 1972. In the intervening years, have you been invited to give occasional lectures in Austria or anywhere else in Europe?
There was a possibility of doing a series of lectures both in Austria and in England. In both cases, a lecture series or a lecture named for one or the other of my parents, the English ones after my mother and the Austrian ones after my father. And I remember in both cases, I was going to do it and then it didn't work out. And why it didn't, I don't remember. So I have not, in fact, done it, no.
Well, more the pity, I think. But you were just in Vienna. Do I understand that you received an honor or award when you were there just recently?
No, there was an honor that came here. The training outfit of the Social Democratic Party, I think that's what it is, established a Marie Yahoda Prize. And I was the first recipient. And they, about seven of them, came here and presented this to me. But that was about a year or two ago, a couple of years ago.
I see.
While I was in Vienna, the Linz people who've been working on my mother's stuff, there was a launching of a new book in their series of things they've been doing. This is the fifth one, I think, which has a new translation of my mother's reconstructions, as she called her memoir, and a translation of a little memoir of women, four generations of women in my family, which I wrote about 25 years ago, and some letters. So there was the launching of that book. So that was one of the events while I was in Vienna this time.
Well, I find it wonderful to see that the memory, the impact and memory of her work get such recognition and honor in Austria, and that there's such a commitment to perpetuating the memory and that work, both your parents. And of course, there's been a major move in Austria since 45 to revive the consciousness, understanding, and knowledge of the intellectual and cultural traditions before the horrors of the 1930s and the World War II years. I mean, almost to the point of fetishizing early 20th century Vienna as sort of making it a talisman to blot out what came after.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
It helps as long as it doesn't blot out all the memories. I think I've learned a good deal from speaking with you about how the Austrian origins affected you and how you found your own paths as you grew up in America and made a family life and a career, a very distinguished career of enormous accomplishment in your research and teaching. And it's really a privilege to be able to speak to you about this and get such sharp memories and observations of all of that. So let me thank you most heartily and wish you a wonderful summer. And I hope our paths will cross again.
Well, thank you very much. I very much enjoyed talking to you. And Vienna is very much on my mind since I've just recently come back from there. So it was particularly nice to have this chance to talk to you.
Well, maybe at some point we'll find a place to get a really first-class Wiener Schnitzel.
Yes.
Which is a little hard to find in the U.S.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Remember to check the episode description to find more from our guest. Follow us on social media or turn on notifications to get alerts for future episodes. The Buchdieber Institute for Austrian American Studies promotes an understanding of the historic relationship between the United States and Austria, including the lands of the former Habsburg Empire, by awarding grants and fellowships, organizing lectures and conferences, and publishing the Journal of Austrian American History. We engage with a broader public audience through digital programming, including videos, podcasts, and blog posts. Auf Wiedersehen, and see you next time.